This is Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the music and the artists behind the 2017 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School and previews upcoming performances. I'm Chris Moore. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. Funding for Festival Showcase is provided by the Barnard Fane Foundation. As we enjoy our final week of Aspen Music Festival concerts, we have a lot to talk about this afternoon. We'll talk with bassist Edgar Meyer about his August 17th concert. Ian Kujara, who sings the title role in Mozart's La Clemenza di Tito opening tonight, and bass trombonist John Rojak of the American Brass Quintet. But first, let's catch up with cellist Alisa Weilerstein, who just played in a concert with Donald Weilerstein and Vivian Hornick Weilerstein. We just had a chance to hear you and several members of your family play together, and you were born into a very musical family. When you are working with other musicians, and I know some of them came from families that had nothing to do with music, do you find that there's a difference between you and people who came to music later on in life and came more independently than you did?
To be honest, I don't find so much of a difference. You know, a great musician is a great musician. I mean, it doesn't matter where they've come from. Actually, since we're speaking of family, actually, my husband is a very interesting example. He started playing the horn when he was 14.
Mm-hmm.
And has no music in his family at all. He was the first one.
Wow.
But before we got married, we played together, we worked together, and I felt enormous, obviously I felt a great connection with him, but not only personally, but also musically. And, you know, we kind of had opposite upbringing. I mean, it kind of had nothing to do with our actual music making together. And I've worked with many other really wonderful musicians. My regular recital partner, Enon Bonaton, who has an amazing career of his own, but he comes from, let's say, an artistic background, but not a musical one. You don't really feel it when somebody is that connected to music.
Yeah, I'm not surprised to hear you say that, actually. And tell me a little bit about your husband, because he just conducted just a couple days ago with the orchestra here. How often do the two of you get to work together? It looks like you're not working together directly this time in Aspen.
Unfortunately not this time in Aspen, but we actually have worked together quite a bit. We've gone through a good chunk of the cello repertoire. It's fantastic. Obviously, we're married, so we kind of like each other. But but he's an incredible musician, a very, very thoughtful musician, and a very, very good accompanist, very sensitive. Not only when he's accompanying me, but when he's accompanying others, I've noticed how attentive he is. We bounce ideas off each other and learn from each other, really. So this is it's a very nice and very respectful kind of working relationship we have, too.
You're going to be playing the Shostakovich second cello concerto, and you're too young to have ever met Shostakovich in person, but I know you've been blessed with some amazing people in your younger years. For example, Daniel Barenboim comes to mind immediately as somebody who really worked out a lot of musical things with the Elgar Concerto. Is there somebody that you have worked with at all with the Shostakovich that really stood out for you and helped you understand
the Russian soul
of Shostakovich?
Actually, I had the amazing chance to play for Rostropovich.
Oh, my goodness.
Which is kind of a direct link to Shostakovich. As many of your listeners know, I'm sure he was Shostakovich's muse, really his kind of principal muse.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote both of his concerti for him. They were, you know, extremely close. And so I actually played the first cello concerto for him, unfortunately not the second one. But I was 22 when I played the first concerto for him, and he sat about 5 inches from my face, meaning that his feet were practically touching my end when I played for him. And so I remember not knowing in which direction to look, because, of course, he was Rostropovich, which was this iconic figure for me, and he was also a very larger-than-life presence. And so it was kind of interesting that I was playing and then not knowing in which direction to look. In any case, he gave me incredible insight into Shostakovich's music. He really kind of brought home the point that expressing Shostakovich's music, while the music is actually incredibly expressive, one can't approach it the way you would approach something that's very directly emotional, such as Tchaikovsky. Even if Shostakovich is absolutely tortured on the inside, on the surface, one has to have a kind of poker face, and that the emotion, while it's very, very strong, is rather indirect. And so this is a great challenge for any interpreter of his music, and I really enjoy that.
He's not a hard-on-your-sleeve kind of guy, and yet,
there's enormous emotion in his
music.
He was, as we know, many, many people considered him to be the voice of the Soviet people. These were desperate times that he was living in. And the other thing which I think we all have to kind of consider is that so much has been written about Shostakovich and his life circumstance and how complex and how generally horrible that it was.
Right.
But we have to also remember what a great composer and artist he was in his own right, and not discount that. I mean, if we only think of the way Shostakovich lived, we wind up thinking about it actually a very shallow composer. He was an absolutely amazing craftsman and orchestrator and artist, and an inspired artist. He lived for music, and I think it's something that actually kept him alive during some of the most fraught circumstances.
I also see in Shostakovich, and this is almost a miracle, a tremendous sense of humor. And
oh, yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah,
some of his music really puts a smile on my face. Yes.
Very black and biting humor, and it's absolutely fantastic. I mean, the second movement of the second cello concerto is actually a very, very good example of that.
Tell me about some of the projects that you've been doing recently that are maybe less standard repertoire music, but things that people might be less familiar with.
Sure. Well, I actually premiered two concerti last season. One was by Pascal Dussertin, with the premiere at Chicago Symphony last June, and then we did the European premiere in Stuttgart soon after that, and also in Paris, and we actually just played it at the BBC Prom, so that was the UK premiere of that. It's a wonderful one-movement work, about 30 minutes of this kind of very slow build from these kind of drones in the cello, on the C-string, so this is sort of the lowest depths of the cello with a bass clarinet, and it starts from these two voices and just gradually expands to this massive kind of explosion from the orchestra, and also the cello, and the cello gets kind of swallowed up in it. It has a really wonderful range of colors, and I think it's a very engaging piece to listen to. The other piece which I premiered is called Un Despertar, which is an awakening by Matthias Pincher. And I actually only played it once so far. We just did the world premiere in Boston a few months ago, and we'll do the European premiere next season. And Matthias Pincher is a longtime friend of mine and also a composer which I've admired for many, many years, and also a wonderful conductor. I just feel very lucky to have really great and very different relationships with these two wonderful composers. And it was a great joy and a lot of really good and hard work to get these pieces premiered.
If you've just joined us, this is Festival Showcase, and we've been talking with Elisa Weilerstein, who plays the second Shostakovich cello concerto this Friday at 6 o'clock. Bassist Edgar Meyer plays every year at the Telluride Bluegrass Festival, as well as here at the Aspen Music Festival and School. His mostly classical recital is this Thursday at 8 at Harris Concert Hall. He'll be joined by cellist Elisa Weilerstein, who we just talked with, and pianist Tengku Irfan. So when you're here in Aspen, it looks like you're doing pretty strong classical, and you've also, in this same season in Colorado, you've been to the Telluride Bluegrass Festival, and you play pretty straight-on bluegrass when you're there. Tell us a little bit about the range of music that you do play in your concerts.
I don't know. It doesn't seem like a big range to me. I mean, it seems like a fairly narrow band because at the end of the day, it's only a certain number of pieces with a certain number of players. I guess one way to think of it for me is that I probably first attended the Aspen Music Festival in 1982. And I first attended the Telluride Bluegrass Festival in 1982. I met my wife here. A lot of my closest friends and their families have been attending both these festivals since the 50s and 60s. So not Telluride Bluegrass in the fact that it's only 40 years old. But, you know, a lot of my close friends have been there from the beginning of that. Mm-hmm. And so both these places are like home to me. And the musical part of it is no different in that this is just music I've been around my whole life, and it feels comfortable.
Everybody has teachers that influence them, but I'm not really sure anybody could have taught you how to be Edgar Meyer, because I don't think there's anybody with the variety of musical styles that you're actively pursuing, both as a composer and as a performer. You're a teacher here. Besides the technique of bass playing, do you ever talk to your students about finding a voice that's unique in the way that you've obviously had?
I don't particularly promote a unique voice. I think I try to get people to do things beautifully. The piece that I'm proud of bringing up and its value is creativity. And I think just making that kind of part of the culture. I mean, there's quite a social interaction with the students, and they really want to be respected by each other. You know, and if somebody plays with a strong tone and they play, you know, in a musically intelligent way and they're in tune, that usually garners a lot of respect.
Well, one thing I find very inspiring about the culture here among the students is that when one of the students walks out and plays, there's hooting and hollering, which are obviously their friends who are playing the same instrument. I love that feeling of support that the young musicians get from their own colleagues, and in some ways, actually, their own competitors, but they don't really see it that way.
It's wonderful. I mean, you know, that's what you hope for. I mean, it's great to live a life, you know, among the community of musicians and feel like you're part of that family. Ideally, that kind of starts as their students.
Let's talk about the concert that's coming up here, Thursday, August 17th, over at Harris Concert Hall. First of all, the acoustics there must be wonderful for you. I'm sure you enjoy playing at Harris.
I haven't done a program like this for a while in there. I know when I listen to things in there, it seems to slightly favor cello and viola a little bit, which shouldn't be bad for me. It should be good for bass.
Well, you've got a concert here that looks like pretty straight-on classical. But is there any part of this concert that incorporates other styles besides pure classical?
Well, there are two movements by myself and two by my son, George. All four of those movements have clear influences from outside of what's usually thought of as classical music. They're fairly old pieces for me. I wrote one of them late 90s, I think, and the other one in 1986. Of course, George couldn't have written anything in 1986 because he was born in 92. But one of them's from when he was in high school. He's 24 now. But one of mine has very overt influences from jazz and rhythm and blues, and it's hybrid. I mean, I don't know what to call it.
Right.
George's are that way, too. I mean, he's got one that's a little more composed most of the way through and one that's a little looser. But I think all four of those movements, people who are familiar with what I do, they would recognize that.
It was a long time ago that I heard Bottesini performed live, and it was actually here in Aspen, and it was when George Mester was conducting. Mm-hmm. So it was back in the 80s, I guess. And the piece was so hyper-romantic and sentimental that first there was a little bit of chuckling and then snickering and then finally actually laughter from the audience. People loved it and they gave a wild standing ovation. What is this particular Bottesini piece like?
I think the one you heard, was probably Grand Duo.
Was that
Gary and Itzhak? Okay. And Gary likes to bring out the funny side of it.
Uh-huh.
The Bottesini that I'm playing is, I guess, he considered it one of his more serious works because he did a lot of things like variations on popular opera tunes and things like that, which was fairly common at that point. He's pretty easily summarized if you just consider the virtuoso playing might be represented by Liszt and Paganini and fuse that with Italian opera a la his very good friends Verdi and Rossini. That's about what this is. It's a wonderful vehicle, actually. I'm a little loose about it. My own attitude is if I'm playing Bach or Beethoven, I put them on a certain kind of pedestal where if somebody can convince me that Bach or Beethoven would have wanted something, I'm going to figure out how to get it. And if Bottesini, he's my buddy. We're collaborators. It's a little different relationship.
So you can have a little fun with him.
Well, I'm willing to say, well, you know, that's nice, Bottesini, but I'd rather do it this way. And I assume he'll go along. Seems like a good guy.
I just think about a traveling bass player who goes from bluegrass to classical. You must have some funny stories along the way. Do you have any things you might want to share with us? Some examples of some of the humorous things that you've experienced in your travels?
I'll start with one that's not even necessarily humorous. It was just revelatory for me. Somebody who's a fairly accomplished bluegrass musician and also a kind of very sober person came up to me one day and said, well, it's amazing how you play like bluegrass and classical. You play music that's so kind of soulful like bluegrass and also so one that's so mathematical like classical.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I immediately deduced that when a person uses the word soulful, they actually mean, I like that music.
Mm-hmm.
And if they use mathematical, they're like, I'm a little distant from that music. And because obviously, I wouldn't have picked those words for either music.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly wouldn't have associated them in the way he did. So it was just, that was a stunning moment for me, just on different people's perception, because obviously anybody in classical music would have picked classical music as soulful music.
Right. And well, I think so they're both soulful. I'm sure you'd agree with that.
Well, if you like it, then it's soulful.
And it's touching your soul. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so I just, I'm just a little slow with the way, I'm probably a little impatient with the way people use some of those words. And then on the funnier side, if you own a bass and you walk around in public with it, then you know that look then somebody sees you, and you know something stupid's coming out of their mouth really soon. We'll probably start with, I bet you wish you took up the
violin or the flute.
Whatever, yes.
Yeah, right. And of course you don't.
I don't wish.
Yeah, you have a companion who's about your size, and that's
yeah, and sits next to me on the airplane and is silent.
And I guess my last question too is just kind of the banter you have among classical people and the banter you have among bluegrass people. Mm. I wonder if it's very different if you're walking into if the musical culture is different enough that it affects how you behave or how you talk with people in those two different worlds.
Once again, it's more person by person than it is style or genre. You know, you can, within either kind of genre, you can have a set of people that interact a certain way and another set that interact quite a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, when you mention the bad jokes, you know, they exist as banjo jokes and as viola jokes.
Edgar, we're looking forward to the 17th for your concert.
I am looking forward to it.
It's going to be fun to see you, and I know many of your friends. One wonderful thing I forgot to mention is just that if you ever want to just run into Edgar Meyer, just go to one of the concerts, because you go to a lot of concerts. You really enjoy hearing other musicians play.
It's a joy. I mean, mm-hmm. and that's part of, I've always loved concerts in the tent and in Harris, but the tent, of course, dates back, you know, for much longer for me.
Right.
It's an experience like no other.
We've been talking with bassist Edgar Meyer, whose mostly classical recital is this Thursday at 8 at Harris Concert Hall. Now we turn to Ian Cujara, who sings the title role in Mozart's La Clemenza di Tito, appearing tonight at the Wheeler Opera House. Tell us about some of your arias and some of the more stellar moments that you get to have, and also how you're interacting with some of the other characters, all of whom are trying to kill you.
Right. So Tito, more than any other character in the opera, I would say, is very solo singing focused. There mm-hmm. are lots of absolutely gorgeous ensembles in the opera, and Tito is in none of them. He's in one trio and that's it. On the other hand, he has three standalone arias and then two chorus scenes, which are essentially arias for him also.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the one that's most well known and the most fun to sing is his third bravura aria called Se all'impero, which is mm-hmm. what happens directly after he rips up the death warrant for Sesto. He's had a whole recit before then going back and forth about, does he kill Sesto, does he not, and eventually decides not to, and this whole aria is him defiantly talking to the gods and saying, if this is what's demanded of me to be emperor, either take my empire away or give me a new heart, because I don't want to do this. It's funny, his act of clemency is a very defiant act in the opera. You mm-hmm. see it at multiple points, both in Se all'impero and in his last accompanied recit. It's almost as if he's saying, let's see who's the better man. It's not just him saying, oh, I'm such a good person, I will bestow clemency on everyone because that's how good of a person I am. It's an act of strength and defiance.
Well, he's really frustrated sometimes because he gives people clemency and they just turn around and try to stab him in the back again.
Oh, seriously? Seriously.
I don't know if I'd have that kind of power.
Yeah, he's finally mustered up the courage to forgive Sesto. Mm-hmm. And then almost immediately after, Vitellia confesses.
Mm-hmm.
And his very first line is, as soon as I discover a guilty man, I discover another one. So yeah, he's quite a figure and a bit of a fantasy, but a fun one to watch.
Well, let me ask you about the whole opera program here at Berkeley and all the people that you're with. We haven't seen you on the stage on the Saturday morning opera scenes masterclasses, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I've kind of seen you around. It looks like you're kind of hanging out with the opera crowd a bit,
definitely.
The opera singer crowds. But tell us, you were brought in specifically to sing this role, and that's really all you're doing, is that right?
Oh, yeah, that's the main thing that I'm doing here. My main job throughout the year is I'm a young artist at the Lindemann Young Artist Program at the Metropolitan Opera. I had been working fairly frequently because Maestro Levine at the Met is a big fan of Tito specifically, the opera.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd been working on it a fair bit, and it seemed like a really cool opportunity to get to do the role in its entirety, especially with Ed, who I've worked with before and adore,
mm-hmm.
and with Maestro Jane Glover, who right. I actually, my very first professional gig was with. I was in the children's chorus of her St. Mm-hmm. Matthew Passion in Chicago. it just seemed like an incredible opportunity to get to come to Aspen, which is quite literally paradise.
Yes.
And get to perform a role that I had already been working on and very much liked. And I don't sing that much Mozart, but I love this role. I also do a fair bit of Idomeneo. And there's something about that style when Mozart writes in the opera seria style that I just love.
Well, I have to ask you a little bit about the Lindemann program, too.
Yeah.
We actually had somebody come into Aspen this summer, Ryan Speedo Green.
Oh, yeah.
Who just a few years ago got out of the Lindemann program and now is at Vienna.
Yeah.
Do you have to be invited into this program and just hope? How did you get in? Ryan Speedo Green told me it was a pretty darn intense program. So
tell us
a little bit about it at the Met Opera.
It's funny. They used to have a very sort of cloak and dagger audition process, which basically involved you working somewhere at some level with one of the coaches that's involved with the program.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would get recommended to come in for an official audition. There was no preliminary audition process that you could apply for online. Mm-hmm. And if enough of the people in the staff said he should go audition for Levine, then you would do an audition the next day for Maestro Levine.
Mm-hmm.
And mine was, we call it an audition, but it was a 45-minute sort of scena that we did where I sang four different arias and we talked a bunch about different singers and about technique and about roles and about opera. And, you know, a month later I got the email.
Oh, man.
Yeah. It was a nerve-wracking process.
I was going to say, here is like the god of opera.
Of opera, yeah.
sitting there in front of you.
James Levine.
He comes across as a very nice man. So.
Oh, he was wonderful.
Yeah.
He was wonderful. Right. Perhaps the most stressful part of that whole audition was not the 45-minute audition. It was the 30 minutes I sat outside of the room while they talked about me afterward.
Oh, I can imagine. How many of your colleagues are in the program with you now? Is it like 8 or 10? Or?
Typically, it's 12 singers and 3 pianists, though I believe next year it will be only 11 singers.
I see.
But there isn't a strict quota for either voice types or singers. Levine chooses to bring the people that he wants to bring.
You sing roles to back up just in case somebody gets sick, but have you also had a chance to be on the Met stage in some capacity?
No, I actually have my Met debut in October as
Great.
Enrique in The Exterminating Angel by Thomas Addis, which I'm very excited about. And
yes.
I'll also be playing one of the sentries later on in the season in Parsifal. Mm-hmm. So I'm very excited about that.
Well, Ian, we are looking forward to seeing you on the stage. My goodness, tonight will be the first night, as opening night. So
yeah.
It's just a few hours away, so we'll let you go get your makeup on and everything. And then there are two other performances. I believe it's the 15th, the 17th, and the 19th, if I'm not mistaken. So do get these. I believe you can even use your passes if you have a pass to get this. But don't miss this chance. You don't get to see this opera unless you're a New Yorker that often. It doesn't get performed all over the country.
No, it doesn't.
On Festival Showcase, we've been talking with Ian Cujara, who will be singing the title role in Mozart's La Clemenza di Tito starting tonight at the Wheeler Opera House. Finally, let's catch up with bass trombonist John Rojak of the American Brass Quintet, who performs Daniel Schneider's bass trombone concerto, Sub-Zero.
Bass trombone is not something I usually hear, and I've actually never heard you outside of the ensemble, just playing solo, and this is major. This is, I think, the first bass trombone concerto ever performed at the Aspen Music Festival in school. Is that right?
I believe that's the case. I've been angling for one for a while, and finally we found a piece that suits the festival, fits the bill, and the only issue I have is that I had to practice the whole summer.
Yeah, that's why you're not as tan as I am, I guess.
That's right.
And actually, there's some serious work that has to be done to prepare this concerto, I'm sure.
My lips can pull a truck right now.
I want to ask you about the bass trombone. It speaks for itself, of course. It's a trombone that's bigger, that plays lower notes. How does it compare in range to the tuba? And also, how would you describe the timbre?
It's a great question, because when I'm on tour with the quintet, basically at every single masterclass I've done over the last 27 years, the question about bass trombone versus tuba arises. So I've had a lot of chances to speak about it and think about it. The ranges are very close. I can play almost as low as the tuba, and tuba players can play as high as a trombone. The timbre is the huge difference. A bass trombone would have a little more focus, a focused sound, of course. The way somebody in Tasmania, when ABQ was on tour over there, described it was, I love the growl, the bass trombone growl you get. I decided to take that as a compliment.
Well, since it said, I love it, I guess that's right. That's good enough.
Yeah, but it can get a little bit of an edge on it when necessary. I do think for myself, and I implore my students to not use the bass trombone as a weapon. I tell them to play a bass trombone should not hurt you or the people sitting in front of you. I think it has a beautiful, warm, rich sound. It can sing beautifully. In fact, most of my musical role models, what I've based my sound on, are more singers than instrumentalists. And of course, there's great role models from great fiddle players, the great Russians that I admired, David Oistrakh and his ilk, and wonderful singers over the years, even to the point of Johnny Hartman and some of the great pop singers. I know in one piece I played, it was a half a measure where I wanted to sound like Bing Crosby.
I'm wondering, that you said that it's important that we don't weaponize your instrument. Let's talk a little bit about that with your composer and why he chose to write a bass trombone concerto instead of a tuba concerto.
Sure. At the Astro Music Festival, since I've been here, I believe there have been three performances of a tuba concerto by student concerto competition winners, usually the Vaughan Williams,
right?
Of course, the classic. But Daniel Schneider, the composer of this piece, which is called Sub-Zero, Daniel Schneider is good friends with the bass trombonist in New York, Dave Taylor. They've worked together in a duo and some other groups, and he wrote this piece for Dave. Dave was a very, very busy studio musician and played with everybody, in New York Philharmonic to Ella Fitzgerald to Duke Ellington to whoever. Many, many jingles and soundtracks. And the piece has a kind of jazzy element. It's not improvised, but it's a very cool piece. Steve Burns, who's conducting Aspen Contemporary Ensemble with some beefed up forces, Steve called me in February and asked if I would be interested in playing Sub-Zero. I had coached some of my students playing it, and I hadn't played it myself. I said, could you give me a minute? Let me read through the piece and see if I think I can do it. And I read through it, and I said, yeah, by the end of August, I should be able to play it.
You're giving up a lot of dinners with friends and things to get to that point.
Only a couple.
Oh, okay. Very good. So you said it has sort of jazzy elements. Does it have very fast passages? Because I know that it's harder when you have a large instrument like a tuba or the pipes of a pipe organ or something like that for them to respond as quickly as a flute does. Does your composer have any concern for that, or do you still do 16th note runs?
There are 16th note runs, and that's what's been taking up most of my time, because I would hope to play them accurately, as if they were on a keyboard, but also with the inflection of the jazz, kind of jazzy style. When we talk about technical terms, about tonguing, which we would say ta-ta-ta, there's also a faster tonguing technique called double tonguing, which is ta-ka-ta-ka-ta, but to me that is a little hard for the style of music. So I'm just trying to use a faster, softer tongue, which means more hours in the practice room.
Right. Well, I'm excited about that. Well, first of all, the Aspen Contemporary Ensemble, ACE, they really nail things, and I guess they're not afraid of any contemporary piece.
Yeah, and I was just looking at a couple of the other pieces they're playing that they've been through this summer. Some of the parts are amazingly challenging. So I think I've probably had more dinners than they've had.
John, we look forward to it again. That's going to be this Saturday. What is it, at 4 or 4:30?
4:30, and it's first on the show, so please don't be late.
Definitely don't be late. John, thank you for coming to the studio again, and we look forward to hearing you with your bass trombone getting its debut performance of any bass trombone concerto. This is cool.
Thank you, Chris. I hope it'll be cool.
Bass trombonist John Rojak of the American Brass Quintet here breaking away and being a soloist in the new trombone concerto of Daniel Schneider. That takes place this Saturday at 4:30 in the chamber music concert. This has been Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the music and the artists behind the 2017 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School and previews upcoming performances. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. Please join me Tuesdays at 3:30 or online at aspenpublicradio.org. My name is Chris Moore. Thanks so much for listening.